Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, Dr. Kate, and also hopefully Red Beckman will be joining us tonight. He is home and feeling well and today and got some sleep last night and doing a lot better, and we're hoping for a quick recovery for Red and hope he'll be able to join us here shortly, as is our history and our regular tradition here. We open this show with a prayer, and I'd like to start us out that way tonight. Almighty Father God of heaven, we just are so thankful for all the way that you're blessing us, and we thank you for this opportunity to bring this show forward, and we thank you that Blog Talk Radio was able to get all the bugs out of their system after that cyber attack that they received this last week. And Father, we pray for your protection for this show tonight, that we might make it through the 2 hours and that we might bring a message forward that glorifies you. Father, we pray for our country tonight. With what's going on in Boston and other parts of the country, we pray that you bring the truth out, that you show the truth to the people. We know that this media, the television and cable and stuff, these people are not operating according to your rules. And we just pray that you would squelch the lies and the propaganda, and that you would force the truth out so that the people can see it and give the people the wisdom to recognize the difference. Father, we pray that your spirit be with us through this show tonight, and thank you so much for our guest, Jeff Wright, tonight. And just bless this show, Father, and bless our listeners. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Well, as I introduced you, Jeff, on Thursday night, I will let the folks know that you are an IT guy. You're an internet network engineer, and you've worked in naval security in your past, and you've got a lot of experience, including working with some of the communication systems around the World Trade Center. And you've also got a lot of political history under your belt here, especially in Colorado, with the Tabor Amendment and others. I want to open the floor to you again and ask that you'll kind of do what you did as we started the show out on Thursday night, and let the people have a little bit of your history and a little bit how you came to writing your book, The Citizen's Last Stand. Are you ready? And I'll just give you the floor. Thanks for being here tonight, Jeff.
Well, thank you, Terry, and thank you, Dr. Kate. I'm very glad to be here. It's also good to be home back in Idaho after my last month in Denver and around up and down the Front Range doing the book promotion. It was it's kind of a lot of fun, but it was certainly good to be back, although I don't want to go through eastern Wyoming weather again like I did on Friday. That was a real fun drive. But it's much nicer weather up here in Idaho, let me tell you. Not nearly the amount of snow and bad weather that was coming down there the whole month I was visiting. Anyway, I was used to that, but as I said, it was good to be back in Idaho. Kind of to give a little background, I guess, on how I came to write the book, I originally started out as a cryptologist in the Naval Security Group. And then I became, through the course of the next 6 years, I was a technical liaison to what was called NAVSEAC, which was a naval systems engineering activity in the Far East. I was primarily, my duty stations went around the Pacific from northern Japan all the way down to the Ryukyu Islands. and into the southwestern Pacific Ocean. But primarily for about 4 to 5 years, I covered as a system cryptologist on collection systems. I covered a big part of the Pacific, going from duty station to duty station, what are called intelligence collection platforms, typically on the internet and through some of the conspiracy webs. They're called echelon sites, but that's not what the agency calls them. They're platform or collection platform sites throughout the Western Pacific. In fact, they're scattered all over the world at that time. I did that for about, I was recruited out of high school after taking a series of tests for military induction. I was picked out and selected to take this course, and it lasted about 22 months by the time I got through. And coming out the other end, I was what was called a cryptologic technician, M-brancher. There's six different branches in the Naval Security Group for intelligence gathering. The Naval Security Group at that time, it no longer exists right now. It was absorbed into the Directorate of National Intelligence back in 2004. And with the intelligence consolidation that was done under President Bush in 2004, now there are 16 different agencies. The Naval Security Group and the other service, what were called service cryptologic agencies, are no longer exist. They were absorbed. The Naval Security Group was absorbed into the Naval Special Warfare Unit and became information warfare in that NSW group. But working for the in various intelligence agencies, I was farmed out over time as a technical liaison. So I traveled throughout the Far East and the Pacific, building collection systems. We were primarily monitoring the Soviet Union and the Communist Chinese through the 70s. Plus, we did a lot of work in Central Asia all the way over to Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. But we had quite an extensive collection effort going on, primarily started out for Cold War purposes. Later on, it started to turn into other efforts that were not so much national security based, what I call dirt collection, what I call it in the book. We started collecting a lot of dirt on our adversaries and allies as well as our outright enemies. After I left the Naval Security Group, I decided not to continue there as a career because of what I'd seen in Central Asia and then a number of other things that went on at that time during the late 70s. But I did stay in the defense systems, complex systems business as an engineer, as a systems engineer. I wound up working on the Consolidated Space Operations Center down in Colorado Springs, which today is known as Schriever Air Force Base and is part of Air Force Space Command. Basically, during that project, we built most of the platforms and the mission control centers, along with the tracking and telemetry that was developed for the Air Force Satellite Control Network. The Satellite Control Network is basically controls the bulk of our satellite arc out in space that monitors both military communications and does a lot of ground-based imaging, tracking, reconnaissance, all kinds of things happen now through this through the Air Force Space Command, and through what's called the National Reconnaissance Office, which controls all of our mainline intelligence assets in space. After about 11 years or so, I was tired of that and decided that the complex systems environment for military procurement was just completely out of control. So I thought I'd go over to the commercial side for a while and see how things work there. So from about 1988 on, I started as a senior consulting engineer for Bank of America. I proceeded through a whole lot of financial and banking firms, a lot of familiar names in the Fortune 50. Primarily, we built networks from the late 80s through the 90s for a large piece of the of the top end of the banking and financial system. That culminated at the end of the 90s. I was working almost exclusively on Wall Street by the end of the 90s, building systems for the Fortune, about half of the Fortune 50 in Manhattan, the surrounding boroughs, New Jersey, New York, all the way down into Washington, plus a number of other government contracts from the FDIC to the International Monetary Fund, the NASDAQ, NYMEX. I mean, there's just we were basically rebuilding the entire electronic computer and communications infrastructure through most of the 90s. And from 1995 to 2000, I was focused completely almost exclusively on Manhattan, building large-scale systems for Citigroup, MasterCard, Manufacturers Hanover, Chase Manhattan, a whole lot of very, very familiar names within the Fortune 50. About 2000, in 99-2000, it became apparent to me that they were building a giant financial Ponzi scheme. Almost everything we were doing by the end of the 90s was just building large derivative trading platforms. And as soon as you figure out exactly what they do, it becomes apparent that they represented weapons of financial mass destruction. So as I tell most people, by 2000, I come to the conclusion that we were headed for a financial meltdown of unprecedented proportion during the early part of the 21st century. And so I decided to pack in my consulting business. I gave up virtually all of my consulting contracts in New York, which were quite valuable, and I was in the process of closing down my my consulting business and terminating, either unilaterally or naturally, as the case may be, all of my contracts in New York, and basically ran out of there like my hair was on fire by the end of 2000. By 2001, we had just a couple of contracts left in New York on 9/11. Unfortunately, on one of those contracts with Marsh McLennan, one of my senior engineers, Nancy Nguyen, was killed working on the Marsh McLennan contract on 9/11. She was in the North Tower above where the first plane hit, and she never had a chance. That event, and when the towers came down and I watched basically a decade worth of work go up in dust, smoke, and death, I decided that there was a whole range of things I had to do politically that hadn't been touched for a long time, and that's how I got involved on the political side. I had been involved to some degree since the early 90s in Colorado when I became involved with the Tabor Committee. Petitioning to put that on the ballot, and then one of the five people in the state that acted as coordinators with Douglas Bruce to get it passed in Colorado. Through that experience and a number of others, I became more and more increasingly politically active as I saw the military-industrial side as well as the financial and commercial side really turning into one gigantic game. And at that point, I'd come to the conclusion that this was all going to come to no good end, and I just kept increasing my political activities. So by the early 2000s, after the towers came down, I spent the next 7 or 8 years working extensively throughout Colorado and other states. It culminated in 2007 when I was hired by the Ron Paul campaign as a state field director for Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. So after that experience, that's when I, when people finally started jumping on me after 2010 saying, look, you got to write all this down somewhere. That's when I got on the book project and took off writing the Citizens Path and to try and warn my fellow citizens what they were about to face. And my goal was with the book to try and explain to people exactly how they could take action themselves to restore the republic, get this project underway to save this country from the people that are dead set, it seems, to take it apart. So that's kind of a summary of, a short summary of the last 30-some years, but that's how I got to the book project and what made me get involved in this.
Well, one thing I've gathered from, you know, reading the as much of your book as I have, I'm probably about halfway through it, or maybe a little over halfway through it. That struck me, Jeff, is your passion for people and the country. You know, it wasn't your negative attitude that got you to walk away, for example, from the NSG. It was, to me, it looked like it was your love of people and your love of truth and your high level of integrity that turned you away from that. And you still hold on to that. I mean, your resistance, for example, to buy into conspiracies, for example, I believe is you just have such a genuine passion for people that it's very difficult for you to go someplace else other than to try to find a positive solution to the things that we're facing. And I see that throughout your book, and I think that's going to draw people to you even more than it does people like Red and myself, and I won't say Dr. Kate. I won't include you in that, Dr. Kate. You can volunteer yourself there, but we have hardened up, if you will, a little bit, and that's a dangerous thing for us, at least for me. So I'm trying to cling to a little bit of that love and passion that you have obviously held on to, and I don't want to distract you from talking about your book. I think that you know, this is a good place to kind of launch off into what prompted you to write The Citizen's Last Stand, more than just the fact that somebody said you need to write some of this stuff down. Now, obviously, you recognize that we had to change direction.
Yeah, well, that became very, 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 very clear that there was a fundamental transformation going on long before Barack Obama hit the hustings trying to get elected. We've had a problem for quite a long time, and I was watching it completely from the inside in all of the places that it was being worked directly. Inside the technological bowels of both the military-industrial complex and the technological bowels of the commercial, industrial, and banking industries that I was building these information systems for. By the end of the 90s, when I was a chief consulting engineer for Bell Laboratories, working on all these different projects for the clients, it was very apparent that the Republic was coming more and more to be in jeopardy. Primarily from a large-scale set of habits that were being adopted at virtually all levels of the government and what I call the corporatist sector, that is more akin to fascism than it is to capitalism. It has nothing to do with capitalism. It has everything to do with controlled and directed economies and marketplaces. And the systems and the scale of the things that we were building became apparent to me. As I say in the book, this was not my granddaddy's constitution and my granddaddy's republic at work. I guess you could say that the passion comes from, it's almost genetic in disposition, because my family with my sons has been in this country for 8 generations. My grandfather, 6 generations before me, he was part of the 4th Regiment of the North Carolina Regulars. That were in Colonel Faxton Regiment under Washington that fought to get the independence that we have. And it's something my family is kind of tracks the history. We've always, in our family, we've always kept track of our family history. And, you know, we're kind of the middle of the pack Americans that we've never achieved great prominence. We've always worked in the system, done our duty, worked for this country for the last 6 generations. I'm the 7th generation, and I feel a particular kinship to it. One of the things that struck me hardest when going all over, traveling all all around, but particularly on the East Coast, every time I come into Washington, D.C. for a project or into New York or Boston or anywhere along the East Coast, I would usually get picked up at the airport by an Indian or a Pakistani or some other nationality cab driver, and many of them were studying for their citizenship. So we always got into some really good constitutional discussions, and what struck me most directly is that I virtually had none of those discussions with my friends, family, neighbors, because they never read the documents. Being born here, they didn't seem to have very much interest in actually learning who they were as Americans and as citizens. It was kind of natural in me and my family. We grew up in a, I grew up in a Goldwater household in the late 50s and early 60s when I was just a kid. And those things made an impression on me. I was very tuned into, I watched both the Democratic and the Republican national conventions in 1964 on television and was fascinated by the process at work, and I wanted to learn as much as possible. My dad was also a huge...
I see that. I'm just trying to ring back Jeff here and get his connection back on. I don't think he realizes it's dropped. It's showing busy, but I'm sure we'll getting back on here in just a second. Kate, you want to come on and just say hello for a minute here? And has Red joined us yet?
Let me see. I'm looking at a number. Red, is that you? Is that you, Red?
Is it a 360 number?
Nope. But sometimes he dials in. Sometimes, as you know, the number is a different one.
Right. Jeff, I think we've got you back on. Is that your connection popping in and out?
He needs to probably call in on a landline or call the show.
Yeah. He just dropped again, so he hung up, actually, I'm sure. Well, this book is a very interesting book because it comes at things at a little different perspective. And sometimes we have this tendency to blow right by a lot of stuff when we think we've got the answer on something. His book is very... very detailed and talks a lot about what he's observed, and I think it's really good, a good coverage of the topic. And we keep having a connection problem with between he and I, so there's Jeff back. Jeff, if you may need to call in on a phone, or would you like for me to call your phone? You can also type on the Skype connection if you want to let me know something. Yeah, he's calling in on the other line. I'll probably just need to dial him up. Hold on. Yes, Jeff. Several times. Would you like me to call you? Yeah, you can. It was popping, and my other connection is fine, so it was on your end. Would you like me just to call you on your phone? Would you like me to just call you with my Skype on your phone? I'll call you on your phone, okay? All right. All right, I'm just going to call him up, Kate. If you've got something to perhaps report for just a minute, that would be good.
Not much to report, except we had a nice spring snow here this morning, which made me laugh. And, of course, it's beautiful. And also, since I'm away from my spring and summer clothes, I was very happy that my winter clothes still work for me here.
Well, it's a good thing.
So I would suggest if you don't reach him, to have him call in on the guest line with his phone.
Well, we may have to do that. We'll see here in just a minute.
And what would be his area code, by the way?
It is 208.
Okay. I'll put a little music in here while you're waiting.
That's okay. We'll have him back up here in just a second, and I've got plenty to say. I don't think we need to go there. And here he comes.
Hey.
Well, now hopefully we won't have those technical difficulties.
What was happening? I didn't know. It only became apparent to me at the end.
It was your Skype connection that was going in and out. And we're still online. We have a live mic. And you were talking about your father when you dropped, and I'm not sure where you were going with that, but if that helps you remember where you were going.
It was probably what I was talking about was my dad's interest in the Old West. He was very much a history buff, and he loved the Old West, and I grew up learning all kinds of things that were well outside what I was being taught in history, about how many different stories there were and about the old mining towns all through the West, all through, in fact, the development of everything west of the Mississippi. And that's where I just grew up a passion for how much people had sacrificed to build this country, what was done to build this country. And it became apparent to me that it seemed to be washing away in a little more than a generation with the behaviors that people were exhibiting. Everything was just convenient, and people were not were shocked at how low political IQ most citizens had as to understanding how a republic works, our government is supposed to work, their own state and local constitutions, or state constitutions as well as local county charters and various aspects of government that people were completely unaware of and spent 30, 40 years saying they were Republicans or Democrats, but did nothing but vote it. They didn't understand the system. They didn't understand politics. It was like it was all supposed to run on automatic pilot, but it doesn't.
Well, hello? Yes. I'm getting a message from Dr. Kate that you're still, for some reason, coming in and out, and it's not being a very good quality. I'm wondering if I could ask you to call directly into the call-in number. Do you have that handy, and is that something that you can do?
Yeah, the 303 number?
No, it is.
Okay, wait a minute.
It's the 347-838-9176.
Okay, say that one more time.
347-838-9176.
347-838-9176.
Yes, if you don't mind, if that's not too inconvenient.
I'll call right back.
Thank you.
And just dial 1.
Yeah, hit a 1. Wow. You know, this is an important discussion, and I hope we can get far enough along into where Jeff is coming from on this, because I really believe he's going to relate to a lot of people with where he's coming from on this. And I know that we go a lot further here on this show, Kate. Is that you ringing me up there?
Hello.
He is live. Jeff, you have a live mic.
Okay, I'm back, huh?
Yes, you are on and you are live, and you were talking about your growing up in a family that was a Goldwater family and had a love for the West and how that kind of brought you to where you are.
Well, between that and the political experiences as well as the professional experiences I had through military intelligence and on into the commercial industry, I saw that a lot of things that were going on were way out of kilter. I spent quite a bit of time while I was working both with the Naval Security Group, the National Security Agency, and then during the time that I was a defense system contractor, I was also taking a lot of college credits working on my degree, and I spent a lot of time in international political science, international law, and between that and my study of the Constitution and the Declaration and the founding documents, I just saw that there's so many things that were so far askew and that we were headed down the wrong path, and it seemed that a lot of people were not, they were allowing themselves to conveniently be misled way off track. And this has progressed since 1950, and I was trying to, the purpose of the book was to try and develop a way to communicate to people my analysis of how far off track we were and come up with a plan that was realistic for an individual to become what I call Citizen of the Republic version 2.0, and for us as Americans to take control of our destiny once again, instead of having it hijacked by all of these narcissistic personality disordered megalomaniacs that we seem to be hiring as elected officials and our leaders in this country for quite a long time.
Well, what got you involved in Tabor? How did you actually get involved in that kind of political scene? That was pretty heavy duty back then.
Well, by the time I came to Colorado, I was hired in advanced research projects at Federal Express, which was a fascinating company, and I'd been here in Colorado for some time. And after my experiences in the intelligence business and defense business, it seemed to me that the first thing that we needed to do was take control of our politics right out our front door at the state level. As part of a long-term project, I figured that it would be impossible to ever take control of the federal government from the state level again if in each of the states we don't have control of our state government or our local government. I just don't know how we can expect to get control of our national government, because the power of the federal government emanates from the states. And if the states, you don't have control of your state government, you don't have control of your federal government. It seems to be axiomatic, in my view, that that's the only way it can happen. So Tabor, when it came along to me, and after spending some time talking with Douglas Bruce about the nature of the project and what was involved in the amendment, that this was one of the best ways to do it. And as the Independence Institute is published several times, I think their last review showed that since Tabor was enacted in 92 and went into effect in 93, that from 93 to 2010, Tabor had saved the taxpayers of Colorado just at the state level between $11 and $13 billion. That's a huge chunk of money. And it also is reflected in the size of the economy of Colorado and the per capita income and per capita GDP. If you take a state like Idaho, for instance, Colorado and Idaho started out at virtually the same numbers for per capita gross domestic product, per capita income, and per capita state taxes in 92. Well, if you compare the two states today, Idaho without Tabor, Colorado with Tabor, their population growth has been almost at the same rate percentage-wise. Idaho is a much smaller state. However, the percentage of population growth has been about the same. But if you look at the two states economically, Colorado with Tabor has almost 30 to 38% more GDP, more personal income, and yet has state taxes per capita that are lower by somewhere around 30% than that on that side. State taxes are lower per capita, yet Colorado's income and GDP per person are much higher than Idaho in the same during the same period. So that, to me, pretty much demonstrates the effectiveness of a constitutional amendment like Tabor, and that was clear to me when I joined in 91 to start the signature, to get the signatures, and then get it on the ballot, then work to get it passed. There was about five people around the state of Colorado that worked directly with Douglas to coordinate all the campaign around the state. You know, that's why when the governor was calling us all terrorists for even proposing Tabor, we were working our butts off because the legislature had failed over the previous decade to do anything to really rein in government spending and to allow votes on taxes and to follow any kind of a formula. So Tabor was a way to the people telling the government, look, you do what we tell you, and this is what you're going to get to spend. And the people of Colorado agreed, and in fact, they agree more now than they did when it's passed. Since Tabor was passed, it's continued to go up in the polls to where now it enjoys 58 to 59% approval throughout Colorado through thick and thin. So that kind of demonstrates, not just in the numbers, but in the sentiment, how people feel about Tabor.
Well, we're certainly glad to have it there. It saved our bacon on more than one occasion. You know, maybe you want to describe what Tabor was about a little bit.
Well, Tabor primarily has three effects. The first effect is it only allows state revenue to grow at a rate of inflation. at the rate of inflation plus population growth. Inflation, of course, being based on CPI, the Consumer Price Index. Now, whether you know that's a good indicator or not, that's the formula that was put into Tabor and has been accepted. I think inflation is actually much higher, but the accepted rate was the Consumer Price Index, so that plus population growth, the government budget was allowed to grow year over year by that amount. The second effect was is anything collected above that amount had to be refunded back to the taxpayers who were paying the taxes if the state and local governments collected more money than they were allowed under the Tabor formula. So the third feature in that really was the ability to vote on every tax within each jurisdiction, that no government entity could raise taxes on the people without having a vote of the people. And the people of Colorado have always shown, you know, pundits want to say that people aren't smart enough to do such things, but the people of Colorado, if you notice over the years, have shown a great intelligence for knowing when to vote their own tax increases and when not to vote their own tax increases. And governments that continually misbehave at any level and simply fail to produce good management and good government, they don't seem to get the tax increases every time they demand one that governments that are managed well do. And occasionally, even ones that are managed well, the people apply management pressure and say, you need to do better. We're not going to give you that tax increase at this time until you can truly demonstrate performance. And so over the past 20 years that's been in place, it has worked very well to constrain the growth of government, and that has helped the economy tremendously. If you look at that $11 to $13 billion that's just been saved at the state level, that money kept in the private sector economy probably multiplies 3 to 5 times. When you put a dollar into government, typically you lose anything from 20 cents to make maybe up to 60 cents, a 0.8 to 1.6 return, a multiplier. When you keep the money in the private sector, that's why the GDP and the personal income is growing over other states in the West that don't have Tabor, because That dollar kept in the private sector multiplies 3 to 5 times, not 0.8 to 1.6. So the multiplier effect actually generates that many more times economy. If you that $11 to $13 billion turns into $50 or $60 billion in additional GDP for the state, and that's reflected in the numbers once you digest all the numbers that the state publishes on the state fiscal situation and the economy. You see that Colorado has hugely benefited from Tabor in that sense of how much economy has grown because we've avoided growing that much government.
Well, my co-host, Red Beckman, has said on many occasions that he thought one of the biggest problems we've had in this country was that the people stopped electing tax protesters because all of our founders were tax protesters. And the other problem, of course, is that the people believe the lies that they're told, and they seem to be addicted to that, which brings up the topic of Warby. You want to tell the folks what Warby is?
Well, the two central chapters in the book where I go into the relationship between personal behavior, and a lot of these things were developed with my business partners and I as we were doing the consulting. A lot of these methods and techniques that I put in the book and talk about in the book, from the Warby paradox to how individual behaviors work with the power elite, with the political system, those things were developed as we progressed and were more and more successful with large organizations. And what the Warby paradox stands for is we are run by idiots. Okay, W-A-R-B-I, Warby, is we are run by idiots. Typically what you find out when you walk into any corporation or you look around in the political system is that the behavior of most individuals is the first thing I identify as wrong is that the leaders are all screwed up. And what happens is when you look at behind the scenes, you find out that the actual behavior of the employees is what is screwed up many times. Hello?
That was Red Beckman saying something to his wife, not realizing we had given him a live mic.
Okay. But that's what we find out is the same behavior that you find in a lot of companies where they think that it's the management that's screwed up. They're screwed up because the employees allow it to happen by their own behavior. And that's the paradox part of the Levy paradox, is that when you do an examination of people's own behavior, whether it's in the political system and how people let their elected officials behave and the fact that we keep reelecting these bad incumbents and, as Red said, non-tax protesters in government that don't seem to understand how to limit government, we let them get away with the behaviors, then we blame the problems on them when we are, in fact, the sovereign people that are supposed to make those decisions and are supposed to manage our government and are supposed to discipline our elected representatives, but we just let them run wild once they get into government. And it's like all of a sudden the elected officials become omniscient and can see every problem and have a solution, and everything they try gets screwed up because government is not supposed to be doing more than half of what it's currently doing at virtually any level. It was never intended to work any other way, but yet people let it go on. And this Warby paradox is the recognition that the way to fix the problem with your leaders and your managers is to fix the problems in yourself first and then apply the discipline to your managers and your leaders, and the system starts to work a whole lot better.
Well, obviously, you state that it's really important because of this that people get educated, and that we educate people and bring a lot more people to the level of knowledge that some of the folks here that listen to Walls in Our Minds have gotten that kind of education over the last few years. And we've made a great effort, and I think we've woken up a lot of people. But like Red said some years ago, you know, he was preaching to the wall. He was, nobody was listening. And all of a sudden, now that people are in pain, their ears seem to be healing. Have you experienced that?
Well, as you find out when you raise kids, you know, when they're 13, you as a parent are obviously insane to your children. Then all of a sudden, when they hit 24, you somehow become a genius. And that seems to be the same situation going on here. A lot of people that were complacent and apathetic and out of the political system and did really nothing more than vote for a long time, then wondered why things were going so badly, they woke up all of a sudden and realized that, that people like Red, and I have a lot of respect for Red Beckman. He's been in this. I can remember first hearing that name probably in 1980 or 81, 82 for me, and hearing about the things that Red was doing to try and wake people up, try and get them active in the understanding the incredibly, incredibly divisive and destructive nature of the tax system that we have built and allowed to take over this country for most of the last century, or what I call the progressive century. There was very few people that were out there 30 years ago talking about these issues in public, trying to wake people up. And it was difficult because, hey, everything was working fine, wasn't it? It was great. I mean, everybody was making money, and nobody ever questioned how they were making money, why they were making money, and why the system that was being built out of fake Federal Reserve notes and an income tax system that was completely debilitating to the economy because of the way it could be manipulated and misdirected and distorted, all kinds of economic behavior. Well, the physics of economics eventually takes over, and that's what's happened. The physics of economics and bad money policies are now overwhelming virtually every other aspect of the fiscal and financial system, and they're about to completely take control unless every individual comes to understand their relationship with what true free market capitalism is and what true economies are, and begins to work in a way that devolves power away from this destructive centralized architecture that we've built over the last century that's trying to control everybody's life right down to the minutia in every way possible. And most people who are now coming to understand why that doesn't work and how it doesn't work and what we have to do about it. And that's where I think the book really goes to the core issues of those human behavior aspects in chapters 8, 9, and 10, and to a degree through the discussion about how propaganda and the media works to get people to understand how easily they're misdirected, misled, and allow themselves to be mismanaged on a massive scale. So it's just a learning process that people have to go through that so few have ever recognized what's happening over the last 50 years.
Well, one of the things that we've shared with our listeners a lot on this show is the fact that we believe that the people are more responsible than the government or the banksters or whoever you want to point the finger at, because we've allowed this to happen. And I don't know if you're familiar with Yuri Bezmenov or not, but he was a KGB agent that defected and has been teaching seminars on subversion. And one of the things that he said that struck me was the fact that you cannot subvert an unwilling target.
That's absolutely correct. You can't. People love the blissful convenience of ignorance. And because it allows them to concentrate on nothing else but their own personal material gain and wealth and their own personal growth and development, but it does nothing. That convenience does nothing to help protect and assure liberty in the system, because it doesn't exact any discipline on that system to make sure that what the judges are doing is right, What the Congress critters are doing is right. What the legislatures are doing is the right thing to do. And so, of course, we have the mess that we have because we don't have any credible legislators or elected officials in almost any branch of government at any level. They're mostly just pandering to people's wants and desires and not to the actual and true needs of government. We've spent all this time trying to eliminate that from the population, and to a large degree, they've been successful. It's only the small percentage, the remnant, as Ron Paul and others, and as I've picked up in the book, it's only the remnant that seem to be aware of what this country was actually about and what it, where it was supposed to go and how far off track it is from where it should be at this point. I mean, we should be a tremendously different country at this point from what we are.
Well, indeed, but we've been in the middle of this subversion process for a long time. I mean, have you, I don't know if I'm going to talk about this, have you seen Yuri Bezmenov's seminar?
Yes, I have. I've seen a couple of them.
Well, obviously, we're in very late stages of that subversion process. We've had our religious foundation destabilized. We've had immorality normalized. We've had our education system taken over. We're in the final throws of that subversion. And when we start to talk about solutions, we really kind of have to acknowledge where we're at and how we got here. And I think your book does a pretty good job of laying that out. If you get into the spiritual battle in any kind of detail, I haven't reached it yet. And one of the things that we talk about, Red brought out, is the fact that, you know, Christ was tempted by Satan in the desert by saying, if you'll bow down before me, I'll give you all these kingdoms. Well, it appears to us, and my research has confirmed for me, that there are a substantial group of people in the world who have succumbed to that temptation. They seem to worship Lucifer. They certainly don't care about fellow man. They seem to be supporting his goal of reclaiming God's creation. And to some extent, he has empowered them to accomplish this. And there is a great spiritual battle going on. Have you given much consideration to that?
Well, in what I'm trying to do, I've given it a lot of consideration. But in order to do what we're trying to do in the government sector, one of the things that I try and concentrate on is sticking to natural law as it is self-evident to everybody. And like I said, as I've found over a large period of time, is that I've found as many good constitutionalists among non-Christian immigrants to this country. Once they understand it, they understand that that the secular requirement of government, the self-evident nature of government, has to rule in a common society when you have many different religions, many different cultures. And in fact, it can work, as Jefferson pointed out when he said, whether a man believes in one God or 20 gods, it doesn't matter to him as long as he neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. And that type of government is the one that we're trying to get to, okay, is that
indeed.
It is based on natural law rights.
Well, even the founders acknowledge that those unalienable rights come from the Creator. They don't come from a constitution. They don't come from a government. They come from our higher power, that being our Creator God. And if you look at what they've tried to do and have effectively done, they have been taking God off of the top of that pecking order and moving him to the bottom. Where the pecking order should be God, the people, the Constitution, the government, in that order, they've done everything they could in their power to reverse that order. And I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, trying to reach a broader audience, if you will. But it doesn't change the fact that there is a spiritual battle going on, and that our enemies understand quite well that they have to take God off the top of the pecking order in order to attack our unalienable rights.
Well, they can attack our unalienable rights whether God is in the pecking order or not. See, that's the problem that we have, and this is what they're doing. And so one of the things is people are having their rights affected whether they believe in a Hindu God. In this country, whether I have friends who are Buddhists, I have friends who are Shintos, I have friends who are of many different religions, including some from Islam, and the friends that I have all agree on the same principles of the Constitution and natural law. So whether they're Christians or any other, they have a place here in America as long as they follow those self-evident principles, and that's the nature of governance in the society that the founders were trying to build. So that whether it didn't matter to them if the a person who they thought their creator was, as long as the self-evident nature of the universe operated and was observable to them. What I mean is that if I'm a Christian and somebody else is a Hindu, we are affected by gravity exactly the same way. The self-evident natural forces that exist in the universe and are observable are the same between all of us, and they are common. And we're always going to have discussions about whether it be regarding right to life or various unalienable rights. We're always going to have the debate at the margin of exactly how to apply those self-evident laws among men and women in the population. However, we can agree that they operate exactly the same way between us, no matter what our belief in the origin is. And that's how we can actually find common ground in this type of government, which is what the founders were trying to get across. You know, when I read The 5,000-Year Leap by Cleon Skousen, I was struck by the fact that even as a strong Mormon believer, he could enunciate the principles of Cicero and Aristotle and Socrates equally, right along with the same features of natural law that fell out of his belief as a Mormon and what he pointed to in other Christians that fell out of their Christian beliefs of self-government and natural law. Everybody could come to the same understanding as that in government, right, when we're talking about governance and self-governance. And that was what struck me the most about some of the spiritual battle that's going on. It is a spiritual battle, and it is going to have consequences. But the fact is that objective morality found in natural law is the single best governance device that we have ever discovered among a disparate global population that could give everybody freedom if everybody follows the same principles objectively between them. And that's where we've come to the real problem here, is we have too many subjective principles being enunciated that don't self-govern across the entire population. And that's why we're going to get, if we don't resolve this soon, we're going to continue this battle in a way that is very detrimental for a large percentage of the population, because they'll always be arguing at the margins and they'll never agree on the core values that make the principles of natural law and self-governance work, as enunciated in the Declaration and framed in the Constitution.
Well, I'm sure, you know, I don't want to stay on this topic that long. I'd really like to move toward your solutions. We also have a caller with their hand up, but would like to ask a question, which we'll get to here in just a moment. So area code 707, be a little patient here. I'll get to you. You've tried to pull various groups together, and you and I had a conversation about that. We thought that there might still be some benefit in that. And I'm sure that you've seen this sort of discussion on the on natural law as being possibly one of the ways that you tried to pull them together. Is that true?
That's correct. I think by focusing on the commonalities that are obvious in natural law is the way that we find better solutions for the disagreements that we have among the various liberty-minded people that exist.
Would you like to take that call?
Sure.
Area code 707. Hoping Kate's giving you a live mic.
Hi, Terry. Doug Millar. Good to hear your
hello.
Voice.
Hello, Doug.
Good to hear your guest.
Do you know Jeff?
No, I don't, but I wish I had met him while I was there. I was living there for 3 years investigating the Columbine High School massacre, but here's my point. I'm really impressed with your guest, but I'm concerned about his natural law, because is he a libertarian?
Ask him.
Yes, okay. And, of course, I know a lot of great libertarians, but do you have any friends that are Satanists?
No, I don't.
I was hoping you'd say that, because you have all these great intentions, but you're not dealing with the core issue, which is a foundation of God under our government. You have a satanic symbol on your book cover. It's the inverted star that's been a satanic symbol since the 1500s. I would encourage you to take that off and people would trust you more.
The star simply represents the individual. The individual is breaking through the, if you look at the cover, the individual is breaking through the red-blue ideological brick wall that seems to exist. The only thing that the star represented when a friend of mine developed the cover was the individual rising above the red and fighting through the red-blue brick wall at the bottom of the page. You see,
well,
in the background.
I like the breaking through. I mean, that's good symbolism, but you don't want to use Satan's symbol to promote your agenda because, you know, I didn't figure you would say you knew any Satanists, and I trust you don't because you've done so many great works. But please listen to Terry and get more serious about your relationship with God and Jesus Christ, and I think you'll be much more effective in Colorado and nationwide.
Well, my hope is that we can all be effective if we're working together for the same principles of freedom and liberty. I think if you and I were to sit down and discuss face to face, that we would find that we probably have 98 to 99 or better percent in agreement on virtually every issue.
I suspect you're right.
The 1% disagreement. I have found it hard in my entire life, and I've been on the earth 57 years, not as long as some, a little longer than others, but I found in that entire time that the people that I can agree with on all of those, that many issues, for the 1%, we can seem to get along in peace very well and can progress as a civilization without having to agree on the other 1%. So I think that either way, you and I would find absolutely very little that we couldn't be friends about. In fact, I would suspect would probably become very, very good friends if we knew each other over time.
Right. I agree. But please consider what Terry is trying to wake you up about, because natural law is not the answer. It's the foundation of the law that came from the Ten Commandments and the Bible from God. This natural law is nothing without God.
Yeah. Jeff, are you familiar with Doug Millar at all?
Excuse me?
Are you familiar with Doug Millar?
No, I'm not.
Well, Doug's been a radio personality for a long time, and like you said, he's been fighting for the truth about Columbine ever since it happened. And he's also somebody who's worked with John DeCamp, if you're at all familiar with the Franklin cover-up and a lot of the pedophilia and some of the the cultish brainwashing and that sort of thing. Doug's an expert on all that stuff and has been a fighter for this stuff and for these kids on the milk cartons and others for many years. So I just wanted you to be aware of who had called in here. I have to admit, Jeff, that one of the first things that struck me when you gave me that book at that the gun show we met at was the fact that I saw the emblem of Baphomet on the cover, which is the inverted star. It does, for those people who are familiar with that sort of thing, it really strikes them pretty hard. And I did not assume that you by any means had that put on there for any other reason than what you just mentioned. But it's going to hit a lot of people the same way it hit Doug. And I just wanted to affirm that to you. I'd like to move on to to get into some of your solutions and some of the things that your ideas for how we're going to turn this thing around. Thanks, Doug, for calling in, and feel free to hang in here with us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Basically, what I'm calling for starts with a renewal of what I term the Citizen of the Republic version 2.0. Regardless of what one's ultimate understanding may be about their place in the universe, the one thing that seems to be missing behind that is every individual, and this includes everybody I've found from my Christian friends through virtually my Buddhist friends, everyone that I know in this country and have met, of various ethnicities, background, and heritage, even if they profess themselves to be good Americans, what is missing is their activism in being liberty-minded about being the sovereign and controlling their government and interacting with their government on a regular basis. They don't do it at the community level. They don't do it at the city, town, or county level. They don't do it at the state level. And being actually active. What they do is they participate in various, media-driven means in the political process when election time comes around, and culminating usually in a vote. But after the vote takes place, they virtually disappear from the scene. And I spent years going into all kinds of meetings from the school board to the fire district. I was a treasurer on the fire district for a number of years. I served on committees and school boards, to city council committees, county commission committees. All these different things. I testified at the state legislature, and I served on various committees there and as a volunteer, along with the work on things like Tabor and petitioning. What I found over and over again is that virtually across the board, whether they were professed Christians, whether they were anything from Buddhist to Muslims to none of the above, to atheist, whatever they were, their ignorance of how their local government operated was almost universal. I used to go into Republican and conservative meetings all the time, and the first question I'd ask was, how many people in this room believe in the Constitution? And, of course, every hand would go up. Then I'd ask how many had read it in the last 5 years, and most hands would stay up. But then as I worked down the scale, at 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, hands started dropping. And so when you ask anybody if they regularly read it and studied it against the other founding documents, there was maybe one or two people in a room of 50 or 60 people that did that regularly. But after that little digression, I'd ask the most important question, how many people in the room have ever read their state constitution? And I was lucky if one hand ever went up in the room. And this has been going on for 20 years. And I kept asking the question, why is that? The state constitution is more important than the federal constitution. And then when I pursue further and ask people how often they showed up at their county commission or their city council or school, you know, they did when something itched, and then they scratched it. If nothing itched, they didn't keep track of anything that was going on, and maybe they showed up to vote. You know, not even in a good turnout election year, we're lucky to get 55%, and that's of registered voters. We have about 30 to 35% that have never registered in their entire life. We have people in their 60s and 70s who have never voted in this country. So I guess what I'm trying to do is to come up with a plan first that generates a citizen that really engages when they can. I mean, I'm no different from anybody else. I had a family to raise, a business to run. I'm extremely busy with all those things. But if you don't take the time, all the things that you cherish go away. And they go away for no matter what your spiritual belief or what your religious background or theological understanding or secular understanding. If you don't take care of your rights and liberties, they all go away. And so the purpose of the book first is to regenerate that renewal spirit in the American remnant to say, you know, you can do exactly the same thing as the founders did when they fought for this country. You can start the same exact process now to retake the country that we have. And that's what I ask people to do first, is to get that spirit back to be involved and actually do things for their community. The second part of that moves then to the actual agenda for the states. And to protect the people in the states. And the first thing they have to do is they have to restore the constitutional
right
sheriff. Excuse me? Hello?
I hear you. Are you hearing me?
Oh, okay.
Jeff?
You came back then. Yes. Did you ask me a question?
No, I was just suggesting that you proceed. I wasn't hearing you, what you were saying about the agenda in your particular state.
Oh, okay. Well, I started. Did you hear the part about the restoring the county sheriff?
No.
Okay. Well, that was the first thing that I suggested, that at the county level, after the citizens begin to restore themselves, is the first thing that they approach is right at the county level is restoring a constitutional sheriff in every county in America, because as the chief law enforcement officer, that is most critical. It doesn't matter, as we found out in Colorado here recently, whether you, whether it's your state government attacking your rights or your federal government attacking your rights, the one who is going to assist in protecting you in not enforcing unconstitutional laws is the constitutional sheriff in that county, aided and supported by the citizens of that county standing behind him to make sure that unconstitutional laws are not enforced in that county. That's one of the first and biggest things to do, and I think that's gotten a lot of play lately.
Well, it's gotten a lot more play. It hasn't gotten enough play.
Exactly, but that's why I put that as the first thing in the book, because the timing appeared to me to be exactly right. When I started the book back in September of 2011, I was fairly certain that Republicans and conservatives were going to lose the 2012 election almost across the board. And at Colorado, that's one of the reasons I left Colorado in 2009, because it was fully obvious to me that Colorado was going blue, both from the failure of Republicans to be constitutional conservatives and of the complete failure of Democrats to understand anything about economics whatsoever. I mean, it seems impossible for liberals to even have economic literacy that passes the fourth grade at this point. Anybody that can do math understands what's coming and what we've done to ourselves with debt and deficit spending. And to continue that, and anybody that doesn't believe it, I suggest there's a great little book to read out there by a liberal by the name of Nicholas Eberstadt. It's called A Nation of Takers. And in that 100 pages, there's enough charts and graphs there to hook an elephant, but he pretty much defines from top to bottom the self-destruction of the welfare state. And he does it from the perspective of a liberal who's trying to save it by telling his fellow liberals it's destroying itself. and is going to self-implode fiscally and financially in short order. But it's hard to explain such things to people who refuse to understand anything about free market capitalism or free market economics. And unfortunately, I have enough of my conservative friends who haven't versed themselves well in free market capitalism, but it's virtually impossible to find a free market liberal that has the vaguest of understanding about how markets actually work and what it is that produces wealth in a person or in a nation. So if they understand first how to get a constitutional sheriff in their county, then start to understand the economics, those two things, along with the natural law understanding, are what's going to enable us to actually put an agenda in place that will protect the state.
How would you help people identify a constitutional sheriff?
It's very easy, really. It's just let them get up and start talking, I found. I was listening to the various sheriffs around the state. The best one in Colorado is John Cook in Weld County. He stated unequivocally that he understands his priorities and his responsibilities as sheriff, and he took an oath to the Constitution just like every other elected official in the state. And he understands that he doesn't have to be a constitutional scholar or to have the pretense of being a lawyer, which usually doesn't understand the Constitution, in order to make the determination of what's patently unconstitutional and what laws will not be followed because they are patently unconstitutional within his county. And he's made that very clear. I've heard other sheriffs who say, well, these laws, these recent gun laws, all the gun bills, 1224 and 28 and the whole foul five, as I think they should be called, they said certain ones like the magazine bill was unenforceable, so therefore they're not going to enforce it. Well, that's a cop-out, and anybody should recognize that's a cop-out. If the legislature passed a bill that said no newspaper can sell more than 15 copies a day or no bookstore can sell more than 15 books a day, that law is totally enforceable. But is it constitutional? Absolutely not. So nobody's going to enforce it because it's patently unconstitutional. Well, there's no difference with these laws. You don't have to try and weasel around and say, well, it's unenforceable, so I just can't enforce it. You say, I'm a constitutional officer, the highest law enforcement officer in my county, and I'm not going to enforce it because it's unconstitutional, and I don't need a judge to tell me that. You can't mess with a right, and in that fashion, and anybody can see that who has an IQ above 60. It's not that hard, but yet you have many sheriffs who try to weasel word their support for the Constitution. Or they simply, when they talk long enough, they realize they actually don't understand what the Constitution says, and that's what's become apparent to me in most counties. I've probably listened to about 30 sheriffs in all the counties that I've been in state their position on the possible gun laws that might come out of Congress or across Colorado in the gun laws that came out of the state legislature, and that's a pretty common theme. That they put a lot of weasel words around the fact that it's patently unconstitutional, and they don't need to do that. So you can recognize that up front. And just by questioning for 5 minutes, usually you can find out how much or how little any elected official knows about the Constitution. And it doesn't even have to go to fine details to find that out. You don't have to dig down into minutiae. You just ask them how many powers were granted in Article 1, Section 8, and Section 9 to Congress. And usually that's a pretty good indicator right off the bat what they know and what they don't know. I mean, you can argue at the margins and say, well, I've heard 24, 21, and 19. are the powers granted. It all depends on how you parse the language. However, if you're down to that level of understanding, then usually you have a pretty good chance that they're going to know more than just, Article 1 talks about, the Congress. And Article 2 talks about the president. Okay. You know, if you're only hearing things at that level, you're pretty well sure that your sheriff is no better off than your average citizen. And that's a problem.
Well, I won't name the sheriff that it happened to, but I was speaking at a Tea Party breakfast one day, and there was a fellow was running for sheriff at that meeting, and I asked the audience to raise their hand if they thought they had constitutional rights or they wanted to hold on to their constitutional rights. And of course, some of them looked at me kind of sternly and kept their arms folded, and a bunch of them were like, you know, excited to get that arm up there, right? Well, that guy that was running for sheriff was one of them that stuck his hand up, and I said, well, let me tell you something. I don't have any constitutional rights, and I don't want any constitutional rights, because my rights didn't come from the Constitution. Came from the Creator, and the government is where the Constitution dictates to the governments what their rights are, not what our rights are. And that sheriff, that guy, his jaw just dropped. I mean, I looked over at him, and it was like he was stunned.
Uh-huh.
And now he's one of them that stood up down there in the Capitol building at the Senate hearings on these anti-gun bills and protested against them, because that guy became the sheriff, and now he's one of the best constitutional sheriffs in this state. But, that's the way he started out. He started out not having a clue, really. But he got a clue.
Yes, and, well, that's why I put Chapter 12 in there as a short tutorial on rights, because as we've seen from Supreme Court justices all the way down, we have a lot of problems with the understanding of the difference between delegated powers and what are rights. And, you know, I always remind people there's no such thing as states' rights. There's only state powers. Because entities don't have rights, they only have powers. And this perversion of language and the inversion, both, it's been turned upside down and inside out, of the use of language, where people use terms like constitutional rights and property rights and gun rights when there are no such things, because things don't have rights, only people have rights. And that fundamental understanding is usually when the light bulb goes on in most people, that they haven't exactly understood most anything that's been taught to them about politics or natural law or the Constitution or the Declaration for most of their entire life. They've had a superficial view that hasn't lent itself to understanding virtually anything about who they are as a citizen in this country, much less.
Jeff, are you still there? Kate, are you hearing Jeff? Jeff, I'm afraid we might have lost connection with you. I'm not hearing you. Well, Kate, he dropped. Okay, there we go. I'm sure he'll call back in here in just a moment. Kate, you've been listening to this conversation for nearly an hour and a half. What's your take so far? Kate, do you have a live mic? Well, I guess it's up to me to talk. The reason, if for any listener that happens to be listening to this, it's not familiar with what it means to have a constitutional sheriff, you need to understand that your sheriff is the person that is the highest law enforcement officer in your county. And if you have a sheriff who's taking a lot of federal funds, odds are he may be selling out your county to the feds, and he may be taking his cue from the federal government instead of from the local people. Jeff, I believe you're back on live.
Yeah, I just came back. When did it disconnect?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure where you were going. I know you were about to say something, and it just went dead on my end, so I'm not sure where you left off. I was just explaining to people why it's so important and what it means to have a constitutional sheriff and why that is so important. You know, we talked about it's important to do that, but we didn't really give them the reason why the sheriff is such an important person in your county.
Yeah, well, he's the first line of defense between state or federal government. He is the only elected law enforcement official that stands between the person in the county and either their state or federal government. And that's why he is the highest law enforcement official in that county. He supersedes the president when the president is traveling, and the fact that that has been turned upside down is probably one of the worst effects that's ever taken place. He should have the say when the president is not a monarch. He is not king. When he comes into the county, he is as subject to the laws of that county and that sheriff's authority as anybody else in that county. He is not king. And that's what has been lost in this hero worship that goes on with president. I don't care whether it's Barack Obama or George W. Bush, or you just go back through any of them, even Ronald Reagan. You respect the president, but the only time he's my commander-in-chief was when I was in the U.S. military. He's not my commander-in-chief right now. He's the president and executive authority of a subservient federal government. He is not king, and he is not a monarch, and he is subject to the sheriff's law just like everybody else, to the sheriff's enforcement of law in that county, just like every other citizen. If it's constitutional, if it's not constitutional, nobody is subject to it, and that's what's been lost.
Well, when it comes down to, let's say, the USDA wanting to come in on a farmer for selling unpasteurized milk, that sheriff becomes extremely important to that farmer because he can shut that down. He can stop them at the county line. He's got that much power and that much authority. It's really important for these sheriffs to understand what their power is, especially in working with grand juries. They need to understand it, and that has been a problem that a lot of these sheriffs do not understand just how powerful they are within their county. They also don't understand that their first obligation is to the people and to the Constitution, because they took that oath too. So if the IRS, for example, wants to come in and serve papers on somebody or tie up a person's property in a county, the sheriff can stop them. If he understands that he has the right to judge the law just like every other citizen has the right to judge the law, he can stop those people at his county line.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the sheriff in his county, and again, people have to understand, this comes with the management and discipline of citizens who vote and citizens who are involved and citizens who care and work with the sheriff to make sure. He's no more king or God or anything else than the president or any other elected official. They're all subservient to the people, and they're there to serve the actual law, not some made-up law that's extra-constitutional and totally outside the scope of what's allowed. But if they're working within the Constitution and within the actual law and in pursuance of the Constitution and Article 6, then, in fact, they are doing what the people put them in office for and are enforcing the law as required by their oath. If they're not doing that, then they're serving nobody, and that's when they need to be disciplined just like any other elected official. Hopefully people
well,
get
don't
that.
You,
Sorry?
Don't you believe that the feds tried to buy the loyalty of the sheriff?
Oh, absolutely. They do it through the grants, and they do it through supplying equipment, and they do it through supplying all kinds of things, supposedly as freebies, using taxpayers' money taken from other people.
Well, Jeff, what's next after working with your local sheriff?
Well, what's next is automatically becomes state powers and nullification. And interposition. There's two parts to state powers. There's nullification and there's interposition. Nullification is actively nullifying at the legislative level laws that are passed by the federal government, supposedly because being passed by Congress, making them constitutional, but which when they're patently not, are can be overridden by acts of nullification of the state, specifically identifying that those laws have no force or effect within that state. Now, other states, they can choose to acquiesce. That's their business. But if it's operating outside the Constitution, if the state passes an act of nullification and it comes with specific penalties, then any attempt to enforce that law, federal law within the state, will be met with active resistance by state officials and with penalties for any state employee or government, local government employee who tries to enforce federal law, as well as a federal official in that state who tries to enforce federal law. So active nullification is the first good solution. Next comes interposition, and that's where effectively the state, without actively arresting federal officials or those that are involved in trying to enforce unconstitutional laws in the state. Interposition is where the state basically stands between the citizen and the state and acts on behalf of the citizen to stop the federal government in actively pursuing any regulation or any control within the state, simply by providing no cooperation whatsoever, no additional support, and no policy effect from state and local government that allows federal laws or federal regulations to have any effect within the state. That's interposition, where they stand between. This is where, like the Real ID Act, the states that chose not to affect the Real ID Act in their state database and to feed any information to the federal database.
Are you still there? Hope I didn't lose you again. Well, Jeff, can you hear me? Kate, are you hearing Jeff? I don't want to talk over him. Well, I'm not hearing from anybody. He dropped again.
Hi, Terry. I keep forgetting to unmute my headphones, but yeah, he dropped again. He should be on again pretty soon. I guess I have a question, and that relates to the establishment of the well-regulated militia and its relationship to sheriffs, because it seems to me, I guess it depends on each state's constitution. I think the governor has the right to say yay or nay to the formation of a militia, but do you think that
The governor, is in the executive position and required to facilitate the organization of the well-regulated state militia, and it does vary a little bit from state to state, but in essence, by definition, the militia is a grassroots operation, and it is organized from the grassroots up. The governor does not have the right to choose whether or not the militia can be formed. The governors, for the most part, are not doing their job. Neither are the state legislatures doing their job according to their respective state constitutions. Each person needs to read their own state constitution, just as Jeff suggested early on in this conversation, because they are instructed to facilitate the formation of the well-regulated militia. It's in the state constitutions.
Now let me go further with this, because our governors and state legislators are not doing their job. What we're focusing on now, at least in this part of the discussion, is finding your constitutional sheriff. And that sheriff being the only really constitutional official that stands between the people and the state and the federal governments. So tell me, what is the relationship then between a well-organized militia and the sheriff? Is there one? Should there be one? Is this a new way to move forward as we try to regain our constitutional republic?
There should be cooperation between the sheriff and the well-organized, well-regulated militia. The sheriff does not run the militia, but the militia can invite him to assist them in doing training, for example. The militia can volunteer its services as deputies or for whatever other purpose that the sheriff might need them for in case of emergencies or anything like that. There should be a ongoing communication with that sheriff. For starters, it would be a good idea for the sheriff to have been put into place by the well-regulated militia. The well-regulated militia should be very interested in who their sheriff is and be involved in the election of that sheriff. And if there's not a good constitutional sheriff in that position or running, they should bring one out of the militia and run him for sheriff. So the militia works with the sheriff. It communicates with the sheriff. It is a friend of the sheriff, and the sheriff should be the friend of the militia. But the sheriff does not dictate to the militia and does not manage or run it or form it. But they should have a good working relationship with it, and they should be able to call on the militia. They should be able to call the militia up for anything at the county level, the same way that the governor has a constitutional right, actually, or I shouldn't say right, a delegated right, if you will, to call up the militia in the event that they need to for the militia to defend that state. So the governor can call them, but he doesn't dictate to them, he doesn't run them, he doesn't form them, and that's true of the sheriff as well.
Very good. Thank you. Jeff is live again.
Yeah, I just came back. I have no idea. I don't have any idea where it disconnected. Yeah.
It may be on the switchboard. At least my Skype connection has been solid all night long, so I'm doing good, so I'm just thankful. did you hear what I said about sheriffs in response to Kate's question about what's the relationship between the well-regulated state militia and the county sheriff? Jeff, are you still there? I think we might have lost him again. Kate, did you shut your mic off again? Did you mute yourself?
Yeah, he dropped off again just as soon as he got on. And he was talking about how to identify a constitutional sheriff. Okay, now I'm bringing him back on again. I'll let you know when he's
back live. Jeff.
Yeah, we seem to be having trouble staying connected here.
Yes, sir.
There. Okay.
Did you hear any of the conversation that I was having with Kate regarding the relationship between the well-regulated militia and the county sheriffs?
I assume that that's a direct connection to make there. Is that typically they call them the sheriff's auxiliary, or because they like to stay away from militia these days. But yeah, there's a direct connection between the county the local militias and the county sheriff.
Well, by definition, the militia is a grassroots group, and they should certainly have a good working relationship with the sheriff, and the sheriff should be able to call upon them in time of need, whether he needs deputies whatever he might need. They might serve as a posse, for example, but the sheriff does not run the militia.
That's correct. Yeah, but they have a connection when times require it. But yeah, they have their own organization. The general militia has its own organization, separate from the state or local government, and runs on its own volition, which is different from the special militias, which are those organized and largely funded through taxpayer dollars, and most people know those as the Guard or Reserve. But those are special militias, not the general militia, which is the whole population.
Let me try to get you back on track, Jeff. You were talking about interposition, and the example that I gave, for example, of a sheriff like that sheriff in Indiana who stood up for that farmer that the USDA was trying to prosecute for selling unpasteurized milk across the state line because the co-op that he was turning his milk into was selling it across the state line, and that sheriff interposed on behalf of that farmer and told the USDA to stay out of his county, and if they came back in there and trespassed again, he would arrest them. That is a form of interposition as well on the part of a sheriff. But you were progressing in your items here for restoring the way things should be, talking about interposition.
Right, and I just wanted to mention, so I haven't throughout, is that real quickly, is that anybody that's listening that is interested in the book can go to Amazon.com, and they can read all of these points that we've been discussing through Amazon.com by going
Kate,
to and searching
did
at Amazon.
Lose him again. There you are. You're going in and out, so.
Okay. Anybody can go to Amazon.com and get the book by typing in The Citizen's Last Stand in the search box at Amazon. And under the ebook or Kindle cover, there is a preview where they can read virtually the setup for this in the first two or three chapters, and off of Amazon. So anybody that's interested, please go there and check it out. I think you'll see that most of these things that we're covering tonight are going to be in the book as well.
And I've posted that link for the Amazon link directly to The Citizen's Last Stand in our chat room. And I did that earlier, and I just did it again so that the people that are watching online or watching our chat can pick up that link.
Right. And one of the things that I also do, like I said, because the entirety of the plan in those five chapters are in the book are in much greater detail than we've gone in here tonight. Two groups that are interested in distributing this message, I do sell directly if they just send me an email, which I think you can also post to the group. If they want to buy a case of books, I sell them at wholesale for $15 each, which is $3 less than the Amazon price, plus the shipping is a whole lot cheaper. But that way they can use them. A lot of groups right now that I've distributed to are buying case lots that they use as their own fundraisers. They sell at the regular price to groups and to the public, and then they use it as a fundraising device and also collect money for their organization that they use to buy more books. So that's one method they can do that. But some of the other things that I've discussed in the book are something we got passed in Colorado. I think we talked about it, Terry, when I was at the gun show with you, where we had actually passed Senate Bill 94-0157. That's back in 1994, Senate Bill 157. We passed that called the Federal Mandates Act. Was that...
You're breaking up again on me. I'm not hearing you now. Well, I've got some dead air on my end. Kate, he dropped again. Well, I'm going to post his email address on the chat. so that anybody that would like to get in touch with Jeff and order
he's back
cases
live
his
again.
Books.
He's back live again.
Jeff, you're live. You should have a live mic now, Jeff.
Oh,
I don't know why you keep dropping. Dropped again. Sorry about that. Well, I'm going to copy that and put it in the chat window so that you can get that. We haven't seen anything back of Red since he dropped, have we?
No, but as you said, he probably got another call. Here is Jeff again. I'm going to just it's Blog Talk. It's still probably not as stable as we'd like it to be, so he should be live in just a second or two.
Jeff, you can speak. I think you've got a live mic, hopefully, if you're back on with us.
There he is. There he is.
Jeff,
you have a live mic.
Well, maybe he doesn't.
Well, it's showing live mic here, so I don't know if he needs to press 1 to speak with the host or what.
I don't think so. Not if you've given him a live mic, it doesn't matter whether he hit the 1 or not.
Okay, Jeff, you're live, but we can't hear you. Okay, so he just dropped again. So he'll probably be calling in again.
Okay,
yes.
We've got about 15 minutes to go here. And do you have more questions? Because I'd love to respond to your questions.
Well, I think that people are really searching in light of the events in Boston and the missile that hit the fertilizer plant in Waco, Texas. And the real understanding of the false flags that are going on right now, it's very difficult to trust our police forces. And I think people are looking for a way to move forward. I'm just unmuting Jeff again right now, so we'll see if this works. So
Jeff,
anyway,
you should have
I think
a live mic.
This connection between the militia and I know the Sheriff Auxiliary in Tucson, for example, is definitely not a militia. And I think that they're, not organized in the same sense and not thinking constitutionally. After all, the Sheriff's militia was just right there, or the Sheriff's Auxiliary was there when Gabby Giffords was shot. And I'm not sure that... Well, that's not a constitutional sheriff, Sheriff Dubnik, but I think the auxiliary is not getting it at what I need. Anyway, it is live again.
Jeff, are you back on with us? I'm still not hearing him, Kate.
Nope, me neither.
Well, I don't know what's going on with that connection.
I have no idea. Jeff, if you can call in on a landline, perhaps you're using your cell phone.
I might call him.
See if you can get
even
that.
On the Skype. It's better to have him on a Skype connection than not on at all. So
go for it. He just dropped, so you probably can get him now.
Hello?
We're going to try you this way again.
Okay, yeah, it just kept dropping one after another. I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
Is it all right if I post your email in the chat so that people can contact you for books?
Yes, that would be fine. And, to just put up the email.
That's the Time Warp one, right?
Yeah, jwright@timewarp.com. And if they want to buy books directly, a lot of people just don't like to use Amazon anyway, and that's fine. I'll ship individual copies for people that don't like to use Amazon. The cost is $17 for individual copies plus $3 shipping, so it's around round figure $20 for an individual copy, or as I said, case lots 15 at a time. 24 books in a case for $15 each wholesale.
All right, we've got just about 10 minutes left, Jeff. I'm going to give you the floor and let you close this out however you see best.
Well, I was just curious if there's, you know, if any other questions had come up regarding any of the issues or things that I said earlier on in any of the sections, or something that might have struck you as you were reading the book that caused you to ask a question at the time in your mind, and maybe I haven't answered it tonight.
Well, how about we hit on chapter 20 on what do we do about the feds?
Well, actually, I took chapter 20 in a somewhat humorous manner, because as you see in chapter 20, everything that I propose in chapter 20 basically amounts to a wish list at this point. And the reason I say that is because in chapter 20, or the idea that we're going to get control of the feds in short order, it's simply not going to happen. This is a generational evolution that we're on here that's going to have to take place, or most likely revolution. Hopefully it'll be largely peaceful. I got a feeling that many of the political leaders are not going to allow it to be peaceful to a large extent. They're going to try and make it violent. My hope is that that doesn't come about, and that's why I put together the chapters the way I did. If we did have a chance, of course, in chapter 20, the things I mentioned are things like ending many one of the things, moving towards a balanced budget amendment, actually passing a balanced budget amendment, a severe restructuring of the federal government, eliminating all of the agencies and departments that are unconstitutional and have no recognition whatsoever with constitutional authority. Of course, largely I realize that that's not going to happen simply because they're not going to allow it to happen until the entire budget implodes the federal government and those departments have no choice but to be eliminated and things scaled back more towards the constitutionally defined roles simply by default. I mean default of treasury bills, the sovereign debt, and default on the dollar is going to cause these things to happen. In the meantime, getting control of our federal lands, as I said, is another one of those areas. Returning and restructuring, disentangling the federal agencies from the federal government, auditing and then dismantling the Federal Reserve is an extremely important task and one of the most fundamental. It'll either do it itself as it unravels, or we'll do it in a managed basis. It's basically a matter of choice. But as I said, a lot of those choices simply aren't going to be made because the government will implode before any of that happens at the federal level. So
we live by the thinking here that countries stick around, but governments come and go. I mean, you can look at Italy, for example, and they've had, 40 different governments or something. So
absolutely. And that's, you know, I have faith in the people. The people are going to fix this. They always have and they always will. It is people that have built this country, and it's people that will fix this country. It's not the government. They're the ones that screw it up. And they've been screwing it up for 100 years in successive fashion. So I trust the innovation, the creativity, the adaptability, and the persistence and resistance of the people will outperform the government every time in every way. And when it goes away, we'll still be here. We'll still be standing. We have a lot of things to do, particularly with regard to reforming our defense infrastructure. It's responsible for as much of the federal fiscal implosion is because of the warfare state as much as the welfare state. And when those two things are recognized together, they'll both have to be scaled back in large degree. And there's a way to do that and maintain our proper defense, but it's not the way we're carrying it out right now. We are strategically disabling and handicapping ourselves by spending $1.3 trillion on the police state and on the federal warfare, or the international warfare, global war on terror, in the way that we are right now. That whole structure needs to be revamped from top to bottom, and it's going to happen largely because of the sovereign debt implosion and the dollar implosion more than anything else. But it's going to happen. We just should try and do it in a managed fashion, I think.
I think I skipped you too far. I think when you were lost your connection last, you were just mentioning something about federal interstate regulatory interference, I think.
Yeah, well, what I term in the book is the hyper-regulatory state, which is pretty much added such an enormous burden to people's everyday lives that it's simply not sustainable by a free market economy. And that level of regulatory interference, which is virtually destroying the ability of the economy to produce jobs, is one of the biggest factors we have to correct. We can't keep continuing issuing 15 to 20,000 regulations every year and expecting that we can survive as an economy.
Well, and that's true of the IRS, too. I mean, they have enslaved the people with an unconstitutional tax system. We've got to stop funding. We've basically got to stop funding the payment of interest to a fraudulent debt.
Well, yeah, I mean, the second and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto are a central bank and a general income tax, a progressive income tax. And I think that having those things embodied in the United States is probably one of the most heinous acts of the progressive era ever that has to be stopped and reversed now. The Federal Reserve needs to go away. The 16th Amendment needs to go away, as well as the 17th Amendment, and we can start getting back to, I mean, that's the triple threat of the progressive century, was the 16th and the 17th Amendment and the Federal Reserve Act. In those three things, more damage was done than virtually anything else in our history.
In your fifth chapter, if I can take you back to that for just a minute, you said money, the title of it's Money, It Is All About Dead Presidents. Well, you might elaborate a little more on that title.
Well, one of the... one of the things I try to point out is the real nature of money. And it's really funny that people use this thing every day called the Federal Reserve Note, and virtually nobody that I encounter on a daily basis, the average person, has no idea what it is or how it works. And most people don't have any idea about how money works. And so the fifth chapter is basically to take everybody through tutorial. Plus, there's wonderful ones online. A lot of your listeners might have heard of Money as Debt 1 and 2. Those two online videos are tremendous teaching tools for young people and adults. They'll give you what most college-level courses in finance don't tell people about how money actually works.
Yes, there's a number of good ones. I was sorry to see that one at the Renaissance 2.0 had been taken down off of that main site, but the videos are still in YouTube. If you go to YouTube and look up Renaissance 2.0, you will get a tremendous lesson on the banking system and how our tax system has gone awry and the whole banking system. If you really want to get an understanding of that, that's one of the best ones that I've seen. Jeff, I just want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I trust that, I think we've got the message across with all of the interruptions that we've had with the technical difficulties, and I'm just thankful for your patience, and thanks for keep calling back in, and we will have you back on again. I'd like for you to join some of our other conversations, and I'll keep you abreast of what we're doing here in Walls in Our Minds, and I'm sure you'll hear from some of our folks on your books, and I appreciate your work, and I also want to talk to you further regarding this recall election here in Colorado for some of these state senators.
Oh, yeah. Well, I thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners, and I hope I haven't bored them to death through the last couple hours with a lot of a lot of talk on political things that a lot of people simply seem to have forgotten about. So thank you again, and I look forward to talking further, and maybe we can break down some of the other subjects in a little more detail after some of your reader, your listeners get a chance to read the book and comment back to you on it.
Indeed. And I'm sure the music's going to start in just a moment, but I do really want to talk to you more about this petitioning process. So I'll be in touch. Thank you, and good night, everybody. This is Walls in Our Minds, and we'll see you Thursday night. Bye now.
Daylight again, following me to bed. I think about 100 years ago, how my fathers bled. I think I see a vagabond covered with gold and blue. All the brave soldiers that cannot get hold of it, asking after you. From Armageddon's side, when everyone's talking and no one is listening, how can we buried in the ground? Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your